Services and Women's Wellness. And before I forget, would you please turn off your cell phones, not just turn them so they're mute, but they have to be off because they affect the sound system, and turn off your BlackBerries. Thank you very much. Okay, Rick. Oh, are you doing? Okay, great. Okay. And we're going to have a public hearing this morning on House Bill 3617, and when Rick gets back, he'll come and tell us what that's all about. And colleagues, I asked Rick to put on your desk the articles that have been in the Oregonian that sort of precipitated our knowledge about what is happening in some of these homes that I think it's incumbent on us to address and hopefully help remediate. So, you want to tell us a little bit about the bill?
Yes, and we have the real expert on the bill next to me, so I will defer to her, but in your packet is a staff measure summary with the actual bill explanation. I think it's in your packet there.
I haven't found it.
I've got it. Oh, I'm sorry. We need to hand them out.
Okay. And we should have amendments, and I think we sent some amendments off to you pretty early yesterday, I think.
And there's two new ones this morning.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Thanks. So Rick, would you read the staff measure summary, please?
Sure, Chair. This does create the Quality Care Fund. The Department of Human Services will use to provide technical assistance to ensure quality care and long-term care. It also requires that DHS, I'll just hit the high points here.
Sure.
It does set up a database to include substantiated reports of abuse in facilities. These are community-based facilities for adults with developmental disabilities. It then does change the fee structure. In the original bill, it set by rule. We do have a set of amendments then that will actually set the fee structure for licensing in statute, depending on the size of the facility, for at least residential care and adult living, assisted living facilities. It does then impose certain penalties for egregious violations, such as rape, abuse, and sets a amendments then set a $2,500 per violation for those types of abuses that occur in homes. The dash one amendments, and I will turn and defer to Representative Gelser to see if we want to go through those or if you think they might be changing to the point of their explaining the changes, or do you want to go on with the dash ones right now?
I think you can do the dash ones.
Okay. The dash ones do expand on some things. It does add to the purpose of the fund that training and licensing activities will be some of the purposes the fund is set up for. It also does add that a violation of quality of care standards can be included to put a caregiver on this database that the Department of Human Services will set up. It then also gives some more sideboards or parameters to how a person, once they're on this database as a substantiated abuse, can be removed, the length of time it stays on there, and how they might go about getting their name off of that database if a certain amount of time passes and there's no repeat offense, and then how DHS will process to get off there. It does then redefine abuse from the original version of the bill, and does clarify that this bill does apply to just adults with developmental disabilities in terms of those residing in facilities. With that, I will stop and perhaps defer to Representative Gelser to see if she'd like to add to anything. That's okay.
Sure, Rick. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, Madam Chair. We're waiting to receive, or are they already at our places, the dash twos and the dash threes?
They are.
She's getting up.
Okay. So the dash two amendments are exactly the same as the dash one amendments, except for a single line will be added that indicates that the title of the database is the quality the database shall be known as the Database of Quality Care Violations. Otherwise, it is a complete exact replica of the Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 3 amendments just make further clarification that the database, the requirement for reporting substantiated allegations of abuse to others in a facility applies only to adults with developmental disabilities, that it does not apply to children's mental health programs, mental health programs, alcohol and drug treatment programs, or other adult foster care programs. It's simply adults with developmental disabilities that it impacts, and that is the Dash 3 amendment. And it's my understanding as well that when the department testifies today, they will have some further proposed technical amendments as well.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Any questions before we move on to testimony?
And Grover was set up yesterday.
Okay,
first.
Sure. Okay, over. Simmons, Mr. Simmons, do you want to testify? I asked questions and I didn't look to see if anybody had any questions. Seeing none, Mr. Simmons?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. We have over 300 members, and they care for perhaps 1,000 elderly people in adult foster homes throughout the state. I really don't want to begin my presentation with opposition to this bill, but I would welcome the chance to discuss a couple of factual situations which are of concern. First of all, we support the creation of the Quality Care Fund and the fact that funds, penalties and sanctions and so forth, penalties would go into that fund to be administered by the department. Secondly, we have no objection to a large monetary sanction for the severe types of misconduct which are itemized in the bill, $2,500 for, what are we looking at here, death, serious injury, rape, sexual abuse, and exploitation. There's no objection to establishing a standard like that. We never defended that kind of the opposite. There's no question where the industry stands on good quality care. Our concern, of course, deals exclusively with the role of substantiated complaints. And just for the record, if I may, I'd like to put two examples in the record illustrating our concern and ask you as a committee, what would you do with this type of conduct or this type of situation? The first case comes out of LeGrand, and it involves an elderly lady about 85 years of age who was in an adult foster home. Her daughter had placed her there. Wonderful home, wonderful situation. And the lady had a prepaid telephone card. And the arrangement was that whenever the lady wanted to call her family or anybody else, the provider would dial the number, hand the phone to the lady, and she could be in contact with all of her relatives. And the arrangement again was whenever the card got down to low, just a few dollars left, advise the daughter, she'd put more money on the card, and everything would work out well. Well, at one time, the provider noticed that there was little money on this card, so she called the daughter, alerted him, hey, your mom's card didn't have much on it, you need to put some more money on it. And the daughter said, gee, that's strange, I just put some money on that a couple weeks ago. So that alerted the provider to something's out of line. So she started looking into it and called the telephone company. Interestingly enough, they revealed the date of the telephone calls, the time, and the location from where they were made. It turns out they were made late at night, well after the time for this lady to go on to bed and asleep, from inside the jail. So the provider reports it to the government. The government comes out and cites the provider for a substantiated complaint. Now, there's, in my opinion, there is no intentional misconduct there. There's no culpability and no wrongful act on the part of the provider. Yet the provider's business is going to take a hit if this kind of information goes on to the Internet, spread throughout the world, as a substantiated abuse. Now, that case embarrasses everybody. It embarrasses the department, embarrasses me, and the whole works. But it's something you have to consider if you're going to use the Internet to spread this kind of message. Give you another illustration. Happened here in Salem. At lunchtime, a foster home with a number of elderly ladies having lunch at a table, at their table. And the provider was serving lunch and handling the medications at the same time. So the provider takes a pill out and puts it in her hand, hands it out this way to the lady, the proper lady, turns around this way to pick up another dish of food, and another resident over here, an elderly lady, reaches over, takes the pill, and swallows it. The provider winds up with a substantiated complaint, and I took that case to the mat, and we lost, and paid them $250. So you could argue that there's ordinary negligence there, but there's certainly not gross negligence, and there's no willful misconduct or intentional misconduct. So I think you need to work on this subject of what constitutes substantiated complaints.
Grover, I just want to remind you.
Yeah.
Step back a little bit from the mic.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Yeah, I get pretty worked up over this type of stuff.
He's in love.
Anyway, these problems are not mine alone.
Yeah.
They're really the committee's problems, and they're the department's problems. And the department, I think, is receptive to doing something about this. So my recommendation would be that if we're going to move ahead on this whole subject, that the definition of substantiated complaints be amended to involve intentional misconduct or gross negligence. There needs to be a culpable act of some kind on the part of the provider if you're going to do this. We really believe that it's not constructive to put it on the Internet, and that's where we probably have a difference of opinion.
Mr. Simmons, I have a question for you. I understand that the Oregonian, and I'm not sure if a reporter is here today, but I understand that the Oregonian has been able to put on the Internet or have their own list. So would the list of the two incidents that you mentioned to us, would they be on the Oregonian's list?
I think the Oregonian, I don't know the answer to that, but I did hear the same information you
I'm
did.
I'm hearing a nod. I'm seeing a nod in the back that is on.
Is it?
So that information is already there. And has that affected your business, Mr. Simmons?
It will. If the Internet, the wider spread use of the Internet will adversely affect the foster home industry, because the purpose of that is to dissuade people from placing their mothers in, if you will, into these residents that are listed with substantiated complaints. So it's adverse to the industry. And as you well know, the industry's taken enough damage in the last few years, and they don't need any more hard knocks. Anyway, that's my whole case, and I thank you for listening.
Mr. Simmons, before you leave and before we open it up to questions, I just want you to know my mother-in-law had been in a wonderful foster home for many years, and it was just a terrific experience, and I've grown to really appreciate our great foster homes. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Mr. Simmons.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. One comment, then a question. I actually think the database is about consumer protection, and I don't think it's going to have an adverse effect on the industry, but I do, you know, respect your perspective. My concern is, by not having the database, some of the more egregious things, you know, there are, what's interesting about this process is clearly there has to be some review within the department of how they do their investigations, and I would be more than happy to advocate on the industry's behalf to make sure that happens. However, you have some very egregious things happening out there that this database will bring to light, And I had the opportunity to look at some of the on the database, and you know, bruising, you know, hitting, people getting tied up with duct tape. I mean, these are pretty bad things. And I think the occasional, you know, minor incident that you're reflecting is not the bulk of what's going to show up on this database. And I'm wondering if you think it's all right to not have the database for the benefit of this several miscellaneous incidents when these very egregious things need to be out there for people to be able to make decisions about the care that their loved ones are getting.
Madam Chair and Representative Kotek, did those horrible incidents occur in adult foster homes or in some other location? And secondly, I think the department is strong enough to discipline. It's discipline any and everybody in this industry that needs disciplines and sanctions. As a matter of fact, we have worked, I have worked with this whole subject of complaints for years and years and years. At one point, there was no designation in the file whether it was substantiated or unsubstantiated. And it used to be that if somebody could file, we'll say an employee who was not a good employee was fired, and on the way out she says, well, I'm going to get even with you. So she goes to the department and makes all kinds of allegations which are false, and the law at that time said, well, if you file that complaint in good faith, that's okay. No matter if it's untrue, if you file it in good faith, that's all you had to say. And that was, well, we finally got the law changed to go to the designation of substantiated or unsubstantiated. So that was the first cleanup. And then Senator Menas was able some years after that to get the law changed regarding what constitutes good faith and with respect to filing of complaints. And they use a tort standard. And it all of these things helped to better administer the whole program. Now this bill would be a little further step, if you will, dealing with complaints, substantiated complaints. And I just submit that it needs to be tightened up, and don't make it worse by putting it on the internet with misleading information. Would you object to putting your mother in this home where the telephone card incident occurred? No. It's a good quality home. Or this lady serving medications and some other elderly lady took the pill out of her hand. Those things happen, but they shouldn't be on the internet classified as elderly abuse. That's about all that's where we are. I don't know how you resolve this, but a new definition of substantiated complaint would perhaps help.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair Tomei. Grover, to follow up on what Representative Kotek mentioned about the hitting, bruising, the duct tape, do most of these facilities have policies in place that prohibit that, that type of behavior?
Madam Chair and Representative Olson, yes, there are residents' rights in the statute which spell out the rights of residents, and I don't know those off the top of my head.
Oh, somebody goofed.
No, that's a jackhammer.
It's what?
Jackhammer.
All innocent.
That was not substantiated.
I have one more question. All right, Lord have mercy. Grover, bruising, hitting, using duct tape.
Yeah.
That's all aggression. Would you believe that under normal circumstances, or actually in any of those type of circumstances, that the facility themselves should behoove them to report that as a crime to the law enforcement?
Well, the current law requires them to report. That's okay. And that's a part of the disciplining system that the department operates under. So I guess we have to have something like that. But what the department does about those, and by the way, in all those situations, there should be penalties and sanctions. We have no objection to that at all. It's just these frivolous matters where there is no culpability involved that is the problem, and you make compound the problem if you put it on the internet. That's our only concern about this bill. But there are standards, there are residents' rights, there are systems for penalizing people who do wrongful things, and we endorse all of that. And my 23 years of working with this, that's always been our position. The department knows that. It's very rare that we go to the mat over some difference of opinion, and these two cases were a couple of those. But we've always supported strong standards in the industry. And Oregon, as you all know, is the premier state on adult on long-term caregiving. And Title 19 was changed by Dick Ladd and Senator Packwood. We were the first state to do it all, and it's a wonderful system. And it's just that once in a while it needs fine-tuning.
Mr. Simmons, do you have with you the Dash 1 amendments?
Madam Chair, I do.
And could you look on page 2, lines 16 to 19? And I'm wondering if this definition covers the people who live in your facilities.
Well, it refers to developmentally disabled disability who's currently receiving services in it. 735 is a definition, the 700s are a definition of adult foster homes. 735 is a definition of developmentally disabled homes.
Right.
That's your point.
Right. So do you serve?
No, we do not.
So this bill really would not affect your facilities?
I think that's correct.
That it would not affect your facilities?
Yeah, and that's the point of this, is to limit it to developmentally
right.
disabled. And that's why I was so happy yesterday morning.
We're so glad you're happy. So I just want to make clear that, perfectly clear then, you are saying that this bill, as amended, does not affect your facilities.
No, I know, no, ma'am, that's not quite correct.
Okay.
Because when you read this thing with the law books there and you start patching it together, you do find that it affects the adult foster home industry, and that the commercial adult foster homes are affected by this bill because it still deals with substantiated complaints being placed on the internet, and it refers to the sections that include foster homes. ORS 443705 is a definition of foster homes on page 1, line 15, where foster homes are referred to by statute 444.705.
I think the intent of this bill is to make it applicable to homes for the developmentally
yeah.
disabled. So
yeah.
if we were to make sure that were the case, would you still be uncomfortable with this bill?
No.
Okay. Representative Gelfter.
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe Lori Freeman is going to be here this morning
okay.
to address this issue. She
yeah. Lori, could right. you come up?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I
yes.
thought that's where we were yesterday, as a matter of
yes,
fact. That's
good.
Why I thought we'd resolved
all
the problems.
And so why? Okay, we'll hear from Lori.
Okay.
And then we're going to have to move on, folks, because we've only got an hour and a half, isn't that right?
That's right.
So, okay, thank you for coming, Lori.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lori Freeman from the Office of Legislative Counsel, and I apologize, I was whispering the back and not paying attention to what was going on up here. So if you could refresh or explain to me the question.
Okay, on the First Amendment, dash 1, on the second page, lines 16 through 19, I thought that limited this bill to only homes for the developmentally disabled. So we're just clarifying that.
That is correct, Madam Chair. The we instead of having a cross-reference to the definition of abuse that was in ORS 430.735, because that applied to adults both with developmental disabilities and mental illness, the committee wanted to narrow it down to just developmental disabilities. So instead of cross-referencing that definition, we merely picked it up and then limited it to developmental disabilities. So that would be only cases of abuse against people with developmental disabilities would be reflected in the database.
Mr. Simmons, are you satisfied with that?
Madam Chair,
Representative Maurer.
I guess I don't understand, because this is very confusing how this is written. Section 1, or page 1 of the bill.
Of the original 15. Bill? The original bill?
Yes. Thank page you. 1. Or have we just eliminated that? I'm sorry? No, what about
that's
line 15?
That's still there. That's the problem.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you. I think that part of the confusion is that there are many parts to the bill. The portion that Grover is concerned about is the database, the substantiated allegations of abuse, which is in Section 2, and your Dash 1 and your Dash 2 amendments both limit that section of the bill only to adults with developmental disabilities. Section 1, line 15, references the Quality Care Fund, which is saying that when there is a fine that's levied against an adult foster home, now that is going to go into the Quality Care Fund for training. Okay. So it's two different issues.
That answers that question. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. You bet. Good. So, Mr. Simmons, we're back to you.
I think that makes us happy again.
We're so happy.
Yeah.
Okay. If you're okay, we're going to move on because we've got a lot of people here to testify. Thank you so much, Mr.
Thank
Simmons.
You.
And I know you came yesterday or the day before to testify. I appreciate you coming back.
Thank you. Madam Chair, should I sit back down?
Yes, okay. Thank you. Okay, I think Mary Botkin. Mary, I don't think you live 100 miles from you. Mark, yes, you marked it. You live 100 miles. But in that, oops, that's your oops. I had mine today. So come on up. You, of course, you are. And Jan Kroll and Brian DeLashman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do live 100 miles, but no, it doesn't count. Oh, no, I guess it's only 50.
Never mind. Not round trip.
For the record, Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We represent folks who work inside the DD group homes around the state of Oregon. And our concern with the bill is this is sort of... You can't win on this bill because we are never going to support hiring, keeping, or maintaining any kind of an employee who is abusive to a client. We will never, ever allow that person to stay in the industry if we have anything to say about it. We will support termination. We will make sure that their rights are protected, but other than that, they're gone. And we don't want them back anywhere else in any group home or any facility where the disabled are involved. Having said that, this bill does not create an environment where people have their due process rights protected. And we went on, you know, after the whole Oregonian articles came out, we went on the internet and we looked at the list of names that the Oregonian published. The list was almost 50 pages long. On it was every facility we represent. So every facility that we represent, Coast Rehab, Star of Hope, Albertina Kerr, and employee after employee were on this list. And it's sort of like, have you quit being your wife yet? These folks had no way to get their names off the list. Now it's published. It's sort of like saying, the judge saying to the jury, you know, you will disregard the testimony of this witness. Your name's on the list. your facility that you work at is on the list. And in order to extricate yourself, it becomes unclear. So what we did as a union is we went to our labor lawyers and said, tell us what the process is and tell us what the rights are of the individual. There's a whole wrongful termination issue about whether or not those employees, if they are terminated from their employment based on the list, regardless of what they did, do they have the right to sue over the fact that they have lost their economic security? We don't know. And we're waiting now for a legal opinion from our attorneys to find out exactly what it is they can do and what their rights are. Having said all that, we support the theory of this bill. The underlying theory and the underlying reason for the bill, we support. It's just the words on the paper don't get us where we need, in our opinion, doesn't get us where we need to be. It doesn't address the underlying problems of the industry. A labor pool. It does nothing to increase our labor pool. It does nothing to increase training or wages or benefits for the workforce, which would increase the labor pool. It doesn't do sort of the underlying things that we think are critical to the industry, which is to allow employees to come to work in an environment that is safe for the employee and for the client, that provides for a livable wage and provides for some career opportunities and professionalizes the system. It doesn't do any of those things in a meaningful way that will allow for the development of the employees and the industry. And we don't see ourselves as being in conflict with the industry on this. We see ourselves as being a partner. And we certainly don't see ourselves as being in conflict with Representative Gelser's, you know, motives here. I think that everything that she's doing for the right reasons, and we support those reasons. It's just sort of the words on the paper. So, having said that, we would welcome the opportunity to sit down with a small work group and work out the language that it would take to get everybody sort of on the same page, if you will, so that we can get a bill that does what Representative Gelser wants to do and at the same time gives us an opportunity to resolve some of the issues that we have that we think are pretty easy issues to resolve. It's just a matter of due process for the employees, a way to get your name off the list if it's been wrongfully put there, or a way to separate hitting duct tape. I mean, nobody supports that. That's egregious behavior. But the person who, you know, the case that I always go back to is the case where the client and their caregiver went to the store, they purchased some items. The caregiver was like 87 cents short. The client gave her a dollar. When they got back to the home, the caregiver gave the dollar back. But that is financial abuse. And it shows. It's substantiated. The caregiver said, absolutely, I took the dollar. I paid it back, but I took it. But under the strictest guidelines, that is, I mean, you have to report that. And the caregiver did what she's supposed to do, and she reported it.
Mary, I'm going to stop you for a moment because Representative Kotek has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for being here today. And we've talked, and I understand some of the due process issues that you're raising, and I think there's some good points. My concern is that your concerns rest with the process to which you get to what is essentially a public record and substantiated abuse. All the database is doing is providing another avenue for consumer access to existing public record. There might be a lot of reason to go back and work with the department on how they come out with the substantiated claims, some kind of process for appeal within their investigation process. But that does not get away from the fact that this database is simply publicizing public records so people can have better consumer information. Would you disagree with that?
You make it sound so reasonable. How could I possibly disagree with the way you say it? And in its purity, you're right. How it is used is not necessarily, you know, it's sort of like the scarlet letter. You know, the A no longer stands for adulterer now. Now it stands for abuser or potential abuser, you know, or maybe an abuser or could be an abuser or has been an abuser. You really have to dig down to find out what the, quote, abuse was. And all I'm suggesting is that the database ought to contain information of substantial, of aggravated abuse of people. Because when you think of abuse, you do not think of the dollar loan. You think of hitting, you think of duct tape, you think of broken bones, you think of people. Like the case where the woman fell and, you know, nobody noticed that she had a broken hip. Excuse me, you couldn't see that? I mean, I have no good explanation for that, but that's what you think of when you think of abuse. Am I wrong?
Follow up? I've seen how the database is laid out. That can be adjusted. There's a similar database, as you're aware, that the Employment Department is putting together for substantiated claims regarding child care providers. They go to great lengths to explain their process, what this bit of information means. I think that could also be done in this case. I actually think consumers, you know, the reality is there's limited spots out there. Families are going to be in somewhat of a bind. They have to make sure that their family member is somewhere where they're getting care. The likelihood that they're going to be able to move someone right away is going to be slim. However, they're going to be armed with additional information to go and talk to that provider by the virtue of having this database to really have that discussion. I don't think, you know, the wrongful termination issue, this does not address that at all. That, again, goes back to substantiated claims. How someone uses that data, that's another conversation altogether. And I think you're muddying the waters by bringing it up, to be very honest.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Of them, I don't know how many, Mary, I do not know how many names were identified on those pages. And I don't know how many of those were minor offenses. But I'm curious what the percentage of those will be of those people ever getting a job again, because now they've just been identified as offenders.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, if I was a group home owner, I would not hire anybody on that list simply because of potential liability issues. I mean, if I hire somebody on the list that has been listed in the Oregonian for public record as an abuser, I don't know what my liability is. And I honestly don't know what the answer to that is. Am I hiring and accepting liability for hiring somebody if there's an incident with a client? I mean, I don't know the answer to that. That's a legal question, and there's a reason why I'm waiting for lawyers to tell me what the wrongful termination issues are around this issue as well. I mean, I just don't know.
Mary, we're going to move on. Representative Gelser, and then Representative Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mary, you just said something really interesting. The publication of a list by the Oregonian could create a liability for the employers. With or without this bill, we can't stop the Oregonian from publishing this list, which is already public record. What recommendations do you have for protecting those employees, and what difference is there between what exists today and having the department have the ability to better control the information than the Oregonian?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, I mean, one of the issues that we've been dealing with during the interim is the whole how the department's going to deal with how the list is compiled and who's on the list. And we've been dealing with that with a small group with the department and some of us in small groups around 2175 and the implementation of that bill. And, you know, we are working our way through that. We're just not done yet. And we, we have individuals who are attending on behalf of the union to the small group, trying to be, you know, working in a partnership with the department to find a way to do this. We're just not done yet. The work group has not completed its work yet. And
I'm not sure you answered Representative Gelser's question.
No,
there's already a list there.
Right. You just said that the Oregonian publishing the database creates a liability for the providers. This bill doesn't cause the Oregonian to publish a database. That's already happened. Any public entity could tomorrow publish that same list because this is all public record. How does this change what already exists, given that providers already call the department to ask for this information before they hire people on occasion?
I don't know the answer to that.
Representative Cowan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just interested in making sure that we kind of stay to the point and the goal of this bill. And as I'm looking over the dash, whatever, the amendments to the bill, where we insert on, will be inserted on line two, or page two, line three, a more definitive definition of the term abuse. And then the amendments go on to list death and physical injury caused by other than accidental or natural means, willful infliction of pain or injury, sexual harassment, neglect that leads to physical harm, and again limits it to facilities for the developmentally disabled. Those are all the types of abuse that we're all agreeing, am I correct, mm-hmm. that we need to be doing something about and gets away from the soda pop incident. Am I correct? I mean, do you see that particular amendment is going to clarify the definition of abuse?
I am not sure. I'm going to let the department respond to that.
Okay.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
And I just sort of throwing this out that when we hear from the department, I think the other piece that we maybe could address a bit is to address some of the other concerns that I've just heard are about removing a name from the list, and there's a provision in the amendments that there's a provision for the names being removed if requirements for removal are met. So maybe we can hear a little bit about what more of those requirements are.
Thank you, Representative Cowan. Representative Olson. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Of course.
I think this, you know, having heard kind of the back and forth, this just amplifies the point that we are rushing through a process to come up with a solution, and we've got people that are really not clear on what it's supposed to do. I'm not clear what this is really supposed to do, where we're going. And I guess my concern is I want to say slow down. And let's, because there is a solution that I think that everybody can agree on. It's, you know, I don't want to pass a bill that is going to create a new set of problems that we cannot overcome, and we have to come back in 09 and unscrew up what we screwed up. And so I guess that's why I'm still really hesitant, and I just want to put that up front now before we, you know, march off and vote today, if that's where we...
Oh, we're not voting today. Thank you. We're not going to have enough time to hear everybody today.
Okay.
But no, we're not voting today. Thank you, Representative. Representative Vic Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam.
DIC, right?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that. I wanted to ask Mary a question. Representative Kotek made a good point that apparently the information is there. I might argue that it does make a difference whether it's on the front page or the back page, but the information is there. So my question, I guess, is does this bill and the Oregonians' attention on the issue provide us with an opportunity to step back and say, what's the criteria for being on that list? What's the process? How do we get off the list? All of that. Further, do you think a work group in the context of this bill could address that?
Madam Chair, Representative Gillum, yes, I do. I don't think anybody has any intention of killing this bill. What we're trying to do is make the bill better. And, you know, it sometimes it's easier if you have providers and union and the employee reps and the department all in the same room at the same time talking through the issues so that you get to a product which gets you what you want, which is to get rid of abusive client or abusive caretakers and to clean up the system and to give the public good information when they go to the public records to get to what they want, which is they want to be sure that they're putting their family member in a safe environment with good staff. And that is really the goal of all of us. And that should be our goal. And I do believe that in talking to other people about the bill, that's what everybody's goal is to figure out a way to get this bill in a with the words that we all want, which is we want safe environments that are secure and stable and in which we can have some assurances that our family members are not going to suffer any abuse. And, you know,
I think we're going to have to move on. But thank you so much, and thank you, Representative. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jan. Is that too close?
No, okay. A little bit, yeah.
Okay. Jan Krall. I'm the CEO for the Shangri-La Corporation, but today I'm representing the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, which represents over 5,000 direct care providers. I have given you my testimony. I'll just amplify some of those points for you and talk about some of the other things that I think would be helpful to the process. One of the things I do want to amplify is our appreciation for Representative Gelser's work, her leadership, and her compassion for the work that we do. And that leads us to cautiously support this bill. We do have some concerns about it, but we do not question the intention or have any desire to derail or stop that process from occurring as it can. What we have noticed is that it's really not the bill that's flawed, but a flawed system that it overlays, and I think that's much of what Mary was talking about, that there are problems within the system that may make the bill more difficult to implement and may bring forward other kinds of problems. And those issues, I think, are really what's at the root of much of the disagreement and concern. Of course, nobody supports abuse. Nobody wants it. The issue that we're all trying to suffer through and figure out is how to limit and how to stop the abuse and how to make information available to people so that they can make good decisions. That's clearly the intention of the bill. So, again, our overall concern is whether or not the bill can be effective with the superstructure or the understructure that supports it. And I just wanted to address a couple of those things. Before I do that, I want to say that many of the concerns that we came forward with have been resolved through the process of discussion and talk, and I wanted to point those things out. First of all, many of us believe that in the letters that we would need to be sending out to our constituents or our members of our organizations would include the name of the person who was supposed to have committed the abuse or the substantiated abuser. Sorry. Thank you. And I get more intense and I come closer.
I know.
We discovered in conversation that, in fact, that name does not need to be included in that correspondence, and that's a big issue for us.
Could you repeat that? I think that's
yes.
An important thing.
We understood previous to our conversations that it was the intention of the bill that when we sent out notification concerning our employees that we would need to have their name in that information that went to families and our consumers and other staff members. And it's clear to us now that that's not necessarily required by the law, that we would send out that in fact that serious incident had occurred, but not necessarily the name of the individual. And we think that's very important about some of the things that have already been addressed with you. So we were glad to notice that. We were also concerned that people could never get off of the registry, and now we see that they can within 5 years. There are still some associated concerns with that, but at least it's movement in the direction that we were concerned about. I think it's critically important to notice that the word abuse is not included in the title and that it's been changed so that it doesn't just send this red flag message out that people are automatically assumed guilty. And I think that's very important. I think for us, one of the biggest unresolved issues is the appeal process question, and I do understand that that's an administrative issue and that appeals are not guaranteed by the law. It is a very important practice for us as we carry out our commitment to employees and try to maintain a good workforce that we have some form of appeal process in our organizations, and we're accustomed to most state processes also having an appeal process for people to go through. Why this is so terrifically important to us is that direct care workers hate abuse as much as anybody else, if not more. And they want to help eliminate it. And we need to be able to provide an environment for them where they feel safe in talking about each other's actions and reporting their own actions. And if they don't perceive that they have some due process and that there's some way that that's going to be assessed, I'm afraid that that won't come through in the way that we want it to. So that's, I think, a very important thing for us to consider. While I know it's separate from the bill, that as we look at the foundations that make the bill move forward, I think that's something that I hope will get addressed. We do see.
And I'm going to have to hurry you up.
Okay. Then the other thing I want to say is that I understand that there may be movement toward this, but we're concerned about the quality of the investigations and that the people that perform the investigations have varying qualifications and training from county to county, and that's a grave concern to us. Finally, substantiated abuse means that the evidence supports a conclusion where there's reasonable cause to believe that it may have occurred. I think most of us think substantiated abuse means something happened, and because of that, I would hope that maybe there could be a change in language and one suggestion that came to me was preliminary findings, that there could be different words that might be able to be used so that people didn't feel and judge based on a perception, even though we know legally it isn't the case. So I wanted to bring that. Thousands and thousands of dedicated people work in our organizations, and we really want to support them. It's Aura's position always that if adequate funding were provided, much of the abuse issue would be resolved, and you notice that I have attached our request to my testimony to then again punctuate the importance of that. We also understand that Representative Gelser's bill is one step in a long journey, and there are many, many things that need to be addressed, and it's not for me to know whether this is the moment or not, but certainly we do support the concept very strongly. It's just the details that we have great concern about.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian, and if you could also be brief, I'd appreciate it.
You're stealing my thunder, Representative. Brian DeLeisham, representing the Community Providers Association of Oregon. I'm just going to say, I'm not going to take much time. I spent a lot of time in front of this committee last week. You saw my list. I've attached or submitted my list again, the same email that I sent out to each of you following my testimony a week ago about issues. As you see, going through those, many of those things are things that are administrative issues rather than language issues with this particular bill. And as been indicated before, part of it is putting this structure on top of the other structure and how do they mesh, whether or not we have adequate investigations, complete investigations, county to county, all those kinds of issues aren't directly related to this bill, but they're issues that we brought up. The only issue that I see that still kind of hangs out there is the liability issue. And I don't think anybody knows definitively whether or not this measure increases the liability exposure that a facility has. I will say, and with discussions with Representative Gelser, I think we've come to a consensus that there was liability issues before this bill about the employment situations. Whether this increases it or just decreases it, alters it at all, I don't think any of us know. But I think that's the one unknown that still hangs out there. The one thing that I would like to point out, and it was related to Representative Cowan's question about by defining abuse in the amendment, does that in fact narrow it down to you're only capturing the abuse pieces and all of the other incidents, the pop incident, everything else is then not going to be captured? It's my understanding, if you look at page 1 of the dash 1s, line 5 through 8, although there is in this amendment a actual definition of abuse, the same one out of the statute, I went back and looked at it, you're not capturing for the purposes of the database just the cases of abuse. it says complaints of abuse and all violations of quality care standards adopted by the department by rule. So if there are standards that they've adopted in the past, if they don't revise those, then you still would be capturing as other issues besides abuse. So again, just to clarify, this amendment does not narrow it down just to the tape, you know, the bruises, the assault, those things. The other cases that have been brought in front of you as examples could still be captured. It depends on what the department does. And with that, I'll close. I want to tell you that we want to move forward on this.
Great.
Cautiously supportive of the bill. I'll tell you that we have had many discussions on this as an organization. We're willing to take the leap of faith with the department and with the legislature to move forward. But we hope as we work through those that the issues that we have listed on our kind of checklist are addressed so that we can capture the data we need to and get to the problem. And with that, I'll close. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. And folks, because we've got people here who have come from a distance to testify, I'm not going to allow any questions right now. And we can always bring these folks back. This will not be our only hearing. I know you're in the building, so I can bring you back, right? Jan.
Madam Chair, I left out one tiny point. Should I wait? Okay, fine. It's our understanding that this bill only covers about half of the providers, and we hope that as the process moves forward, half of the consumers, that also will be addressed in the process. Sorry.
Thank you, Jan. Thank you for making that point. Okay, here's my list. Let's hear from the Department of Human Services. Let me see. There you are. Eddie? No, that's wrong list. Sorry. Yes, I know. James Taves, Eva Kotos. Kotos? Eva, tell me how to pronounce that. And Mary Gear? Am I reading that correctly? James, I know you enough so I can pronounce yours. Hi, thanks.
Hi.
For coming. James, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services. Just a couple clarifying comments, and then I'll turn it over to Mary and Eva. Some of the issues that have been raised, we will resolve as part of the implementation of House Bill 2175 that was referenced earlier, which was a bill passed last session, which gives the department authority to create an abuse registry across all populations, not just DD, because of course many workers can go from different parts of the service system from child welfare to seniors to developmental disabilities. And here we're working on the DD part of it, but our long-term goal is to have an abuse registry across all populations and use that actually for employment screening purposes, in which we will have to afford people full due process rights. And of course, in doing that, we will end up across all of our rules in the department narrowing the list of the kinds of abuses that clearly should preclude someone from employment with vulnerable populations, as opposed to some of the less egregious types of cases you've heard today. So I think we will resolve that over time, and we have a work group and all parties are involved, and that's the goal, is to get to an abuse registry that's department-wide, all populations, and abuse cases that clearly are part of employment.
James, excuse me, just
for my clarification, the abuse registry is coming. So prior to that being done, is the list that we keep talking about, the list that the Oregonian printed, the list that precurses this abuse registry, that's what we're working from?
James, do you want to answer that?
Madam Chair, Representative Gillum, this is a consumer protection tool, not as an abuse registry that's intended for employment purposes. So this is more, as it's been described here, as a consumer protection tool.
It's a different list than what?
It's a very different list than the list that the department ultimately will use for employment purposes. Because the other thing we're doing there, we have different abuse statutes for different populations, we have different definitions, and so all of that's going to have to be narrowed to the type of abuse that ultimately is used then in employment screening on an abuse registry. So no, this effort here does not parallel that directly. It's sort of a precursor in terms of providing consumer protection. And I think a lot of the angst has been about how egregious is the abuse in all these lesser kinds of cases. And the heart of the issue, again, is we've had on the developmental disability side, and purposely so, a very expansive definition of abuse. We viewed that as a tool of protection. We wanted to make sure that in our mandatory investigations, we caught all things, including lesser types of events that could potentially represent harm to the client. And again, that will not be the type of events that ultimately would be used for employment purposes. But in terms of the consumer protection piece, it's the information that is available. It is a public record. And ultimately, depending on what definitions we or what administrative rules we adopt to implement this particular bill, we would have to face some critical decisions on whether that entire list or whether a more restrictive definition based on the statutory definition is what ultimately applies, what is a quality of care violation. I mean, that's rulemaking things that we would have to implement, and we would involve all the stakeholders in that process upon passage of the bill. So I can't exactly answer what that would look like because that would still be part of the rulemaking process. But that's the context. I mean, the end goal is to get across all of the populations, use it for employment, and have due process, and that's different from the effort going forward here. And I think we're kind of leaping back and forth on our concerns on that issue. So that's just the context. And if, with that, if I could...
Madam Chair, quick question.
Quick question. If I'm hearing you correctly, if we get the structure in place for this piece of consumer protection, then many of the detailed questions that we've begun to hear here today could be encompassed in the work group process as you develop the rules to implement this legislation?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, well, depending what how this bill ends up in terms of the definitions, I mean, to be decided yet is the quality of care violations, because I think we're assuming, and I think the legislation does intend it to be the more expansive list, not just the more narrower list of abuse definitions in the statute, and that we would go beyond that to the broader quality of care issues. Exactly what that would look like in rule at this point, I can't tell you. We would have to think that through.
Brief follow-up. I know she's frowning at me. But there would be stakeholders involved in the work group in developing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, absolutely. In all our rules, we try to pull together all of our stakeholders.
She's smiling now.
As you can see, I'm trying to rush people. Thank you, James. So who's taking the next?
Yeah. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Mary Gear. I'm the Administrator for Licensing and Quality of Care in Seniors and People with Disabilities. There are two parts to this bill. The first part that's gotten most of the discussion is the database for violations of quality of care. The second part is the part that I'd like to talk about for a moment, and that's the part that creates the Quality Care Fund and looks at the licensing fees and the civil penalty fines that we impose when there has been a violation and puts those monies, which currently go into the general fund, into a special fund that the department would then use for technical assistance and training. In my mind, this is the prevention part of the bill. This is the part where we can use those monies to help prevent the kinds of incidents that you've been hearing about, and in order to help providers come into compliance and provide the quality of care that we're all concerned about. So I have written testimony that I've submitted that has some technical amendments that I would suggest, and if I could just briefly go through those. The first couple are simply to remove the fees and fines that Addictions and Mental Health imposes on their facilities, either foster homes or residential care, and removes those from the fund so that we would have all of the facilities and foster homes that seniors and people with disability licenses instead of the Addictions and Mental Health facilities. So those are the first two suggestions. The second two have to do with the amount of the annual licensing fees. And I know that among some of the providers, there's some concern about what those look like. These are simply suggested numbers. I think some other folks have suggestions, and I would simply say that we're more than happy to work with folks to come up with a licensing fee that seems reasonable that would then feed into the quality fund. The last three additions that I suggest are parts of current statute that have not been addressed in the current bill. And those are statutes that set the limits on the amount that we can impose for civil penalty fines in response to an event. And those limits are $500 a day, $500 per event, and $6,000 per quarter. And given our intent to use the federal guidelines in civil penalties and the suggestion in the bill that there be a $2,500 fine for an egregious event, those limits are not applicable. They actually conflict with other parts of the bill right now, which so would suggest amending those. The other issue I just simply want to point out that we would need to work on as well is that currently two counties in the state, Multnomah and Clackamas, have county ordinances to license their foster homes, and they collect fees as well for the licensing. And so we would need to look at the language in the bill and make sure that those fees continue to go to the county rather than coming to the quality care fund, if that's the drafter's intention, as I'm pretty certain that the county uses those funds in order to staff their licensing program and those kinds of things. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mary. I'm not going to allow any questions right now, and we know you're in the area, so we may be certainly calling you back so we can answer questions and then giving us some new information to look at.
Just really quick, what were the two counties? That's all I'm curious about.
Multnomah and Clackamas.
Multnomah, okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Going to speed you along.
Hi, my name is Eva Kutesh, and I'm the director for the Office of Investigations and Training, and it is at our office where all of these records and files are located that have been put onto the website by the Oregonian. I wanted to just give you a few minutes of background on and context to what these investigations are, not the kind of investigations, but so that I can respond to at least some degree to questions that have been raised about the standard of proof, the consistency of them, and what our process is for investigating. Our goal is the goal of the people that we train to do a competent investigation. That means one that's objective, one that's thorough, and one that's timely. We have four people in the office who review every single report that comes in from any of the counties around the state. We had about 5 years ago a strategic plan that we developed that involved meeting with people all around, including providers and counties, about what was necessary in terms of the investigation process in our system. And we embarked on that plan. It included training all of the investigators in everything from basic investigations to photography of injuries, to specifics around sexual abuse and how you investigate that differently, to interviewing techniques. And I would say from my experience around the country, and I've been involved at, also as the president of a National Adult Protective Service organization, that on the whole we have good investigations. Some of them are excellent. Some of them maybe are poor. I had the opportunity to read many of the reports, almost every one of them that went to the Oregonian as we redacted them, and I would say over time they have definitely improved. We approve every report that comes into the office, and so if we don't think the information is there or sufficient, then we are always certain to get back with that county. We provide technical assistance. We do investigations sometimes instead of the county when that person is new or there's some complexity to it. So I feel pretty good overall about assuring, I think, that the information that we gather is good and that we reach the outcome that should be reached. Now, that being said, the standard of proof, a reasonable cost to believe, has been mentioned, and that is a very low standard of proof. And the reason for that, I think the policy reason, is because we're interested in the safety and protection of the vulnerable population that we're serving. So we're not looking at a clear and convincing standard, for example, which has been used sometimes in arbitrations around employment matters and how that information is used. Probably overall, I think people write to a preponderance of the evidence standard, which is about halfway. And in our training, we tell people that if it's a more serious situation, we expect a more thorough report. Basically, we want to be sure, more sure about something than if it's some kind of a lesser, minor, potentially a violation, as has been explained in financial areas, for example. One of the points I want to be sure to make sure you understand here is that we do not stop an investigation or fail to start one because someone has left employment. The investigation goes forward, nor do we tell employers what to do with this information. We never tell them to fire, not fire, suspend, because we frankly don't want the liability of telling an employee what to do with that information in terms of employment purposes. It's not the only reason that we gather the information. We're also looking at it to prevent abuse, and so we're looking at systems that may be a problem in a home, such as training or the way that people are restraining or intervening with people. So there's lots of other purposes that we do investigations beyond finding out whether an individual did something or didn't do something.
Eva, if you could just wind
sure.
up really quickly, and then we'll ask you to come back because I'm sure people have
okay.
questions.
I think another point, just to clarify on the database that's posted, there are no identifiers for those individuals until recently. We haven't gathered things like dates of birth or social security numbers, so that's one of the concerns I have about going backwards. But certainly we have prospectively begun to do more of that, and we have responded to requests for reports, a number of reports as a result of the postings from both families and increasingly from providers who have been asking us for abuse information, and they carry about a page and a half of disclaimers that let people know that we can't guarantee that this is the person, but here's the information, and we release both substantiated as well as not substantiated because it's all public record.
Thank you, Eva. And colleagues, what I would suggest, since we don't have time for questions today, if you have questions for any of these three, you might give them a phone call or send them a note so they know what your concerns are, and then we'll ask them to come back tomorrow and maybe another day. But it isn't necessary if you put that in writing, but we can also ask them in person in the future. Thank you so much. We know you're working hard on this. So several other people have also written their names down, and I hadn't sort of put them in the equation of how much time we've got here. And so I'm going to ask people to come back tomorrow. But I do want to hear Judy Cuneo and Catherine White. And then I've got another people, Eddie Pludry?
Lard,
okay, and Marie Alvarez. So I'm going to, we've got 15 minutes. I'm going to ask you to take 7 minutes each, and each panel of two, and I really appreciate it. We really appreciate you coming, and sorry that our time is so limited. Arthur, you can come back, can't you? Yeah. Catherine, you can come back tomorrow? Okay, that would be great. Thank you so much, and I'm sorry that our time is so limited. But as you know, it's the whole session is limited, and we've only got an hour and a half in this room today. So please proceed. I'm sure that you've decided among yourselves who wants to go first.
Representative Tremaine, members of the committee, my name is Eddie Plard. I live in Salem, Oregon. I would like to see HB 3617 passed. I think that an online database is a good idea because it will help to stop abuse caregivers from being hired at group homes. I don't want any more people to get abused by the support people that they trust. If this bill passes, the information is available to me on the internet, then I will use it to hire my next caregiver. If a caregiver was abusive, then I would not hire them to work with me. This information would be helpful, help a lot of people with disabilities that are looking to hire new providers. Thank you.
Thank you, Eddie. Nice job. I'm going to allow if there are any questions here, because I know you probably won't be able to come back. Any quick questions of Eddie? Thank you so much for coming. You did a great job.
Did it very well.
May
sit right there.
May have been
Madam Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Judy Cuneo. And I'm the self-advocacy coordinator. For the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. I've been sitting here this morning listening to everybody. And I understand where they're coming from. I can't say that I disagree too
much.
But I'm here to talk about the people
with
DD. Given some situations. It already is a kind of an invasion of privacy. When people have to have
intimate
care. Especially by somebody that you don't know. And then on top of that, having to worry about
abuse.
You're very, very vulnerable. And I've been in that situation a couple of times.
From surgery.
It is a very personal issue. And I think that the registry it would be there so that people
can
make better decisions about who they hire. Because if you think about it, if you put yourself in that situation, you would really want to be picky about who does that care for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was great. Any quick questions? Thank you so much for coming, all of you. Thanks. Do you have any questions of us?
I would like to testify, Madam Chair, on behalf of self-advocates.
Of course. Yes.
Madam Chair and representatives of the committee, my name is Marcy Alvarez. I'm from Milwaukee, and I'm one of two paid support staff for self-advocates as leaders. I'm here today on behalf of SAL's Public Policy Committee as the chair, Ross Ryan, was not able to attend. Self-advocates as leaders is a statewide organization of people with developmental disabilities who are interested in training and developing strong leaders throughout Oregon to become equal partners in policy and legislation that really affects our lives. We're activists in Oregon, and we provide leadership training and develop the policies that reflect our needs. We have over 800 members throughout Oregon, and we're here today to talk about HB 3617. We're in support of this bill because we want to be safe from abuse and neglect. We depend on our caregivers to help us with a lot of our basic needs. Abuse and neglect too often come from the people that we have to depend on for that personal care. We're teaching people how to recognize abuse and how to go about reporting it, but we need to go beyond simply reporting abuse. We need to stop abuse before it happens. By creating an online database, we can keep abusive caregivers from being fired in the first place and give people an opportunity to talk with the caregivers, allowing people a chance to explain the situation. This database will help residential care facilities know if a caregiver was abusive in the past. It will also help people with disabilities know if a caregiver has done something abusive. Many of us work with our case managers or our personal agents to hire our own staff. By making the information available on the internet, we will have access to the information when we hire our own caregivers. Please vote yes in support of House Bill 3617 and provide safer services for people with developmental disabilities in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Colleagues, I'm going to allow one question because I know this panel will not be able to come back. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judy, you mentioned that direct care providers, the type of care that we're talking about is very intimate care. I wondered if any of you could clarify for the committee the types of things that individuals with developmental disabilities rely upon these care providers to do for them.
People need help with going to the restroom, taking a shower, or a bath. Doing very basic care. And it can be very personal. Just because we may have a disability doesn't mean that. That doesn't matter to us. It can be very invasive.
Judy, may I ask you something?
Yes.
Madam Chair and representatives of the committee, I've provided direct care several times. Started working in the field of developmental disabilities, working in group homes as a support staff to 7 individuals, and did anything from changing diapers, giving showers, handing out medicine in a much more appropriate way than was discussed earlier. Hands isn't okay, by the way. But preparing meals, getting people ready for work in the morning, making sure that they have their money in their petty cash account. Mm. Money is a very serious issue as well. And I've not had money going to a store with someone that I'm caring for, and they offer money, and absolutely no. Even if you pay them back, that's not okay. So taking a dollar and paying it back is absolutely financial exploitation. It's just not acceptable. So those are the kinds of things that are really serious, and I can only imagine what it would be like if I needed to depend on somebody to change my diaper for me, or give me a shower, or feed me my medicine and my meals for the day. It's my life, you know, and it's very serious. And I think we just have big hearts and we care for people and we want them to be safe. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you for what you're doing, continuing to do. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for coming today and coming to
talk. And I hire my own staff.
Good for you, Eddie. That's great. Good luck.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We have about 4 minutes. If there is anybody here who would have trouble coming back in the future, I'll give you a quick 3 or 4 minutes. I don't see anybody who has that position. We will be here. We will carry over 3617. Is that all I need to say?
Until tomorrow.
And possibly more. We have a lot of material here, folks. I would appreciate it if you would work, if you have concerns, if you want to talk more about the amendments, If you have other thoughts on amendments you would like to propose, please work on it. Please work. We're not through with the meeting, folks. Gentlemen, we're not through with this meeting. Thank you. So if you have any work on this bill that you need to do, please do that. And we have new amendments that we'll be studying. And please, I want to call your attention to the articles that I had copied of the Oregonian. That's why we're here, folks. This started January 25th. Huge article in the Oregonian, again on November 11th and November 4th. A huge article. We can see the abuse. If anything is an emergency, folks, this is an emergency, that this kind of thing can be going on in homes that we might be able to control, to advocate for these people. It seems to me just important that we do that. There's work that we need to do on this bill, and we can do it, and I intend to do it. So thank you so much. Any quick questions or comments are good for the order?
I mean, this bill is not going to stop the abuse in the homes. If someone is intent on abusing a client, they're going to abuse a client.
This bill will help. It will at least have a list of people who have had problems. If I have my car fixed, if I go to Bernard's Garage there in Milwaukee, I can go on the Internet and see what complaints have been made about that garage. Now, they may not be even substantiated, but I can do that about my car. If I have to put one of my children or my sisters into a home, I want to be able to look on the Internet to see if there have been problems either with the home or with the worker. So it seems to me that's the least that we can do for these folks.
And I'm not disagreeing that something needs to be done, but the only reason we're here today is because of an Oregonian article.
It's not something that
we did or the department revealed to us, which they probably should have done, is the department should have revealed this to us. We manage by investigative journalism.
Exactly, because we don't have the staff to do it ourselves, and I wish that we did.
I agree with that.
Madam Chair?
I wish that we did.
May I make a brief comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I tend to be very cautious about doing legislation, and I respect what I'm hearing from some of my colleagues about maybe we're going too fast, or maybe we have to work out details. I would hope that we can go away and think about the amendments and think about, not making a perfect solution the enemy of a very good bill. And I think this is a good bill. It's a good start. We will be back in 2009 if I don't think we're going to create huge problems with this bill. There are issues that have to be fixed. Absolutely. We made some investments last session in the DD system to try to deal with some of the wage issues. We need to do more. We need to have a robust discussion in the administrative rules process about how we implement this. And many of us will be right there fighting there with you. However, this is a good bill. And I hope we go and think about, I think the public, because of the article, and we can say that maybe not the right route to get to this bill, but that's why we're here. And if we're going to be accountable and transparent and respond to a crisis, which is what I think people in my district want me to do, then I think we really have to do what we can to get something passed in February. So I hope, I'm happy to talk offline about this, but I really think we can do something here that's helpful.
We have about 30 seconds left. Representative Gelser.
Thank you. And I just want to add that self-advocates have been talking to us about these issues for a long time, and many of us at this panel and in the room have been working on these issues for a very, very long time. It's not simply because of an Oregonian article. It's because we have people that deserve to be safe in their own homes, and we can take a step in February to address those issues. And I hope that we are all committed to coming back and making the commitments we need to in policy, practice, and funding to make this population of people a priority, because we've ignored them for far too long.
With that, I close the House Committee on Human Services and Women.